The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back. Here we are at So Very Wrong About Games. It is a board gaming podcast about, you know it, board games. My name is Michael Walker. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Mark Bigney. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well, Walker. Thank you. How are you?
Fantastic.
You keep saying welcome back, and I just want listeners to understand, that's because we've adopted the editorial policy of waiting in the studio the entire week between episodes. I'm beginning to question the legitimacy and the necessity of this practice.
Well, it's not too, like, before, it was like about the fourth day, staring into each other's eyes got a little bit awkward, but yeah. I'm coming back around again. You know, it's sort of like,
I don't mind the staring into the eyes. It's just the refusal to look away as I poop.
So first, we're going to talk about the games we played this week.
Award-winning podcast. Then, ladies and gentlemen, remember that as you submit your complaints.
Then we're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to talk about our number one reviewed game
this week.
Then we're going to talk about our main review this week,
the featurest of feature games,
Voidfall.
I looked it up. We have reviewed every Mind Clash major release through crowdfunding. We have not done a feature game of some of the minor stuff that they've done independently that they've recently, you know, Astra, and Septima is hitting retail soon, and we'll be playing. But anyway, so Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I got to play Great Western Trail New Zealand. This is designed by Alexander Pfister and put out by Eggerspiel. And it's just yet another iteration on Great Western Trail, which is bringing a herd of animals to slaughter or to shipping.
In complete defiance of history and geography. And I'm glad to see that Pfister's insistence on doing historical themes has continued with the published product being radically at odds with any truth or facts observable in the world.
Why, facts are overrated.
Yes, for Pfister, they're merely a state of mind.
So this time it's sheep, Mark. We're bringing sheep. And the hooks in this one are you can now sell their wool on the way to the slaughterhouse before you send them all off. And so that gives you a whole bunch more money. So there's a lot more resources floating around this game. It's leaned very hard into the deck building. There's all sorts of cards on the side that you're going to be adding to your herd deck. And you're going to say, well, Mike, that's just going to bloat your deck and make it impossible to get a decent herd.
Walker, that's just going to bloat your deck.
No, Mark, that's not how it works. All of these extra cards have an icon, which means draw. So you just play them, draw another card. You cycle through these cards, you get all their benefits, and they do nothing to for bloating your deck.
So it's just pure upside. You want to buy as many of these as possible.
Just so.
I see.
And to do that, there's a new resource called gold. You just get it in different places and you can trade that in. There's all sorts of, you know, what the new bandit tokens are. Some of them give you cards. It's all different ways to get all these different cards in the game. And I find it very interesting. It sort of comes with the expansion already in for Great Western Trail, you know, the top where you go through all the different towns and you start putting in little houses.
Made the rail progress far more elaborate.
True. This one is now you're a boat and you're going through all these different islands around New Zealand and you're same sort of thing. But it just seems to flow a lot better in this particular game.
Ha! The boats, they flow.
Just so. And the side sort of thing where you get your employees and things is a little bit different. The employees all line up in the same rows and they get cheaper the more there are of them.
I remember that there were cowboys, engineers, and builders.
Same
principle here?
Same principle. Yeah. You have your shepherds and your sailors and your people that build and your shears. This time you have shears because when you bring the sheep and to get sheared, you can only do one sheep per shear you have.
Ah, I see.
So you need more shears. But that has nothing to do with the turn limit like it did in the old game. The turn limit has to do with these bonus tokens that you can buy that give you all sorts of different things, and that pushes down the token as per usual.
The turn token that determines the overall length of
just
the game.
So.
I see. You had commented when I asked about it earlier in the week that this is possibly your preferred version of Great Western Trail, which is high praise because you're a pretty big Great Western Trail fan. My understanding was that the second iteration you enjoyed as a variant, but you didn't like as much as the first.
Correct.
And so far, it's early days yet, but New Zealand may be your favorite of the lot.
I think so. I've only played it once, but I like how that they've sort of cleaned up, you know, bringing the sheep in at the end. Now there's only like two stages instead of like three A's and three B's.
Right.
Now there's only two. So that goes through there much faster. The deck cycling is nice because, you know, just because if you know Great Western Trail, you want to have the best hand when you get there. So this all helps. And it just seems more interesting. They seem to streamline it a lot better. And
between the new card effects and the prevalence of money, it seems like it's a lot more forgiving than the original Great Western Trail. I remember that one of the things in Great Western Trail, and this is merely a matter of taste, you know, those effects that allow you to, say, discard a card from your hand to get money. It was often less about money and more just any ability to modify what was in your hand was a great boon. And so if this was a cow that wasn't really contributing to a good haul for when you, you know, deliver cattle to Kansas City, because that's how cattle driving worked. Anyway, moving on. So what I'm hearing is that there's a lot more latitude in New Zealand based on your impressions.
Agreed.
Interesting. One thing that does inspire a great deal of curiosity, because I like Great Western Trail a fair bit, I'm very curious about this iteration, is very frequently when you have, you know, a base game with some problems and then an expansion that fixes the problems but then renders the experience perhaps a touch more cumbersome than is ideal, often it is that second edition or that re-evaluation or that re-edition that finally brings in together all those good bits in a cleaner package. And if New Zealand can deliver on that promise, then it sounds like I might share your impressions.
I hope so. They do clean up a lot, but then they add a whole bunch with all these extra cards. So we'll see what you think. I'm definitely eager to play it again.
All right. That is Great Western Trail, New Zealand by Alexander Pfister, published this year by Eggert Spiel. I played another game of Flick Fleet Xeno Wars. I decided to try some solo monkeying around. It's very solo friendly in that it's mostly just practicing your dexterity shots, and you get to test out different fleet builds, because Flick Fleet Xeno Wars really is sort of a hybrid between dexterity and miniatures gameplay. And I was very unsatisfied with my use of some of the big queen ships from the Hive, which is one of the two new alien factions. Queen ships are these very physically large pieces that spawn a great deal of fighter waves with great speed. But in my first game against Walker with them, I really feel like I didn't use them well, and so I didn't, you know, it ended up making me feel like I hadn't really seen what the ships had to offer.
I have to agree. They have this sort of parasite mechanism, and I'm wondering if you got that to sort of click in your game.
I did. It was strange, though, by virtue of the fact that they lead to ship destruction in a different way, because they will strip systems of their discs, making the systems inoperable, but they won't destroy a ship by themselves. Unlike, say, the oars, which is the paradigmatic example of shipboarding in the science fiction context, you either know or you don't. You're either a happy camper or you're not. And if you're not a happy camper, then sometimes that leads to the dancing. But at any rate, so parasites will not destroy a ship. And that is one of the reasons why you need those fighter waves. They're the ones that can finish a ship off. If you load up another capital ship with tons of parasites, it makes them unable to do much, but it's not going to finish the job. I didn't really encounter that much. I did get a couple of parasites in, and they did a lot of work. You know, it leads to a real difficult decision on the part of the victim ship, because in order to get rid of these parasites that are doing damage over time, you have to lose one of your two actions. But if the parasite has already been damaging systems, well, one of your actions gets rid of the parasites, then what? You spend your second action just to repair and end up doing nothing? Or do you activate a system suboptimally? But again, those are the kind of trade-offs that I really like in Flick Fleet, and part of the ship management aspect that makes me endlessly curious about new science fiction large ship-based games. That's one of the reasons why I'm pledged for Acheron's Fall on GameFound, even though I really shouldn't be. And I got to see the Queen's work a little bit better this time, and so I kind of see their appeal. And I definitely doubled down on my impression that in Flick Fleet, whether it's Xeno Wars or any other set, If you find a scenario that really sparks your imagination and you look at it and say, I really want to try out that situation, by all means, go for it. I've played one scenario that was really quite cool. It had the ships were orbiting a gravity well. And so at the end of every round, every ship moved a certain space towards the center. And if it reached the center, it would just get destroyed. And that put some interesting pressure on movement and some interesting effects on the overall state of the table. That having been said, the actual fleet composition, I don't think necessarily has to be married to the specific fleet composition there. I really think the way to go in terms of being able to play with ships and have enough units so that you feel like you're doing some interesting stuff is to just use point values and to err, if anything, a little bit on the high end as opposed to how much they recommend. Because I keep talking about how Flick Fleet is a niche product and it's very, very expensive, but I understand why it's expensive. You do get a fair bit in the box in terms of ship variety. And so, by all means, let people play with more ships. It's still going to be a very, very, very fast game. Unless, of course, you can't hit the broadside of the barn. Maybe all my games are fast because I play against Walker. He loads up with nukes and he just blasts me out of the sky real quick. Anyway.
I'm wondering with this gravity well, because we talked about when you can ram ships. Like, if you're about to be destroyed, you can use your ship as a ram and come in. But if you're not ramming, you can still collide with the other ships, but it does nothing.
Correct.
Now, do you reset the position of the ships to anywhere? Because I'm wondering if the gravity well, if a strategy would be to knock the other player's ship towards the gravity well.
Well, you can definitely force them either through shots or through aggressive maneuvering to make them waste time on movement that they wouldn't do otherwise. As far as the specifics of I'm a little bit confused because every time I play, I have to recheck the ramming rules, in part because I never fully internalized them. It's one of the thorniest rules issue in a very, 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 very simple game. And they've also changed the ramming rules in Xenowars, which, by the way, these are backported rules they recommend. And they do seem cleaner, but now I'm just confused, right? You can make somewhat slightly messy rules a lot cleaner, and that's probably for the best, but now I'm in a state where I don't remember either rule set, and I might be accidentally importing bits from one to the other.
You need to mesh them together, combine them around.
Yeah, exactly. Make a new bespoke wrong rule set every time. It's not a huge deal. It's just every time I sit down to play, it is the one thing I have to remind myself of. This is how ramming works. Anyway, I had a great time with Flick Fleet. I love experimenting with the toys in exactly the same way that I like experimenting with toys in tabletop miniatures games and finding out how different builds work and exploring the play space in that way. And I have to say that when you know you compare it to other dexterity games, it might seem a little pricey, but when you compare it to other miniatures games, whew, it's a bargain. So I'm actually going to be buying more Flick Fleet going forward. I don't know if I'm going to be pursuing the prospect of buying acrylic sheets and having them printed out with the STL files that they will sell you very, very inexpensively on the Eurydice Games website, or if I'm actually going to bite the bullet and try to get the, you know, fully etched deluxe version that is very, very pricey. I'm not really sure yet. But anyway, I'm very glad to have the Flick Fleet that I have. I would like to get more Flick Fleet. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to be, but I consistently find new and interesting corners of the game space to explore, and that's a wonderful thing to find. That is Flick Fleet Xenowars, designed by Jackson Pope and Paul Wilcox, put up by Eurydice Games. It is the fourth box set of Flick Fleet and an expand alone that introduced the alien factions. I highly recommend starting with the original base starter if you were inclined. A splendid experience.
I got to play a game called The White Castle. This is put out by Devia Games and the same designers as Red Cathedral, which are Isra C and Sheely S.
Yes, these are the pseudonyms of Israel Sendrero and Sheila Santos.
And comes in the same size box, and you literally have to, like, organize it right from punching it out in order to get it to fit in this box.
One of those, huh?
So it's the same size as Red Cathedral, nice and small, tons of game in a little box. It is definitely a knife fight in a foam booth. You have 9 turns for the whole game. And what you're doing is you're placing dice. So there's these dice on these nice bridges, and you're either taking the one on the right or the left, and they're sorted by, you know, low to high. If you take the lowest die, then you get to run part of your engine. And if you take the high die, then you don't have to, then you actually get some money, because all of the action spaces you're going to use for these dice have sort of like a pre-roll printed on them, or you can place it on top of dice that are already there. If it's higher than the die, you get money. If it's lower than the die, you have to pay money. And then you're just trying to get the most out of those 9 turns. You're trying to get these 15 people, courtesans and gardeners and soldiers out on the board, because you have things you can run on your own board as well. And when you do some action, it lets you take cards from the board and upgrade your own board. But then the interesting part is that as soon as you take that card, a new card replaces it. So you might be helping the next person because now they can take actions there.
Is that interesting or just unfortunate?
I think it's interesting because there was a couple times during our game that I bet on it. It's like, okay, well, the action I need is not there.
I see.
But there are 2 other people coming. I'm not even going to bother, you know, planning out my turn. And sure enough, Sidewinder took a turn. It's the courtesans moving up in the castle, lets you take the card where they finish. And when the new card was revealed, it had the action that I needed.
Very nice.
And so I think it's very enjoyable. And the fact that you can bring that action down into your board so you'll know you'll have it for next turn as well. All that kind of thing. Very interesting. I'm very much hoping that you can get it tried out because I want to play it again. Lots of things going on. 9 turns, lots of game in a little package.
How long did the game take?
Very short.
Mm. So it's one of those things where you have a small number of actions and that's really reflected in the playtime.
Yeah, it was very much like Red Cathedral as well. In the case that, because I read a bit of a bunch of it as well, like the first game, you're going to get about 40 points, then you're going to get 60, then you're, you know, it's one of these things where once you learn how the mechanisms, your score is going to increase exponentially.
I see.
So I'm looking forward to trying it again.
Well, I mean, it's got a good pedigree. You know, Devir has been putting out reliably good games, and Sendero and Santos, I was impressed by Red Cathedral. Not as much as you were, but it was very pleasant. Interesting to see they're sticking with dice manipulation.
Yeah, and it looks fantastic, too. It really reflects the sort of period. I don't know what to say.
It's about Himeji Castle, isn't it?
It is.
I see. Well, then. Is it actually about a castle? Because Red Cathedral wasn't really about a cathedral.
No.
Okay.
It's about optimizing those 9 actions the best you can.
I fell for it. That's the way Castle in different games. I played a game called Forgotten Depths. This is by Peter Albertson and Void Knight Games, fulfilled last year after successful crowdfunding. This is a co-op exploration kind of dungeon crawly thing with a very minor emphasis on combat as compared to other games. Forgotten Depths is interesting in that, first of all, the art style is very pleasant. It's sort of a John Howe-esque kind of watercolor, faded but very compelling line art sort of style with an all-female cast. And it is about exploring these huge cavernous relics of past civilizations with these towering cyclopean statues that nobody knows what they do anymore, and delving to find resources in a kind of sort of vaguely post-apocalyptic set. Anyway, the setting is interesting, and I think it's well communicated by the art style. And what it seeks to do is a fusion between a card-driven combat style and cooperative tiling to explore the dungeon. The way that it works is you pull tiles from this deck of square cards, and as you make certain patterns in the dungeon, that allows you to trigger various kinds of encounters which are favorable to you. But you cannot explore or access areas of the dungeon if they are behind, say, a monster. And so eventually you're forced to combat monsters to get to the thing behind them that you really wanted to get to, whether it's the boss, whether it's that neat feature you just unlocked, or whether it's just to open up the map in general. Because one of the loss conditions is if you pull a tile that you cannot place such that it is accessible to the party, you immediately lose. And so sometimes you're like, we're getting to a risky part here. We need to kill a monster so we can go forward. The combat is, I'm going to say, not entirely without choices. It's enjoyable, but mostly what you're doing is just popping cards and seeing what happens. There's some interesting management aspects that kind of make up for substantive decision making. It gives you kind of the illusion of control, but I wouldn't say that it's replete with solid decision making. And for what it's worth, this is more or less exactly what we were looking for. Basically, the person I was playing with, Dr. Contra, came to me and said, I want to do a sort of fantasy adventure thing that is not like hyper grimdark and not entirely about fighting. I'm like, sure, shouldn't be a problem. Wait, what do I have that answers to that criterion? I realized, you know, it's like, well, you know, Tainted Grail is super dark. Doomrock is super dark. And most of them are all about combat. Oh, Forgotten Depths. I still haven't tried that one. I pledged on that at Kickstarter. Talked about it on Pledge of Indifference. And sure enough, it was more or less exactly what the doctor ordered. It was okay. We don't really feel the need to go back to this level of the dungeon. There are three levels of the dungeon. There's a certain amount of replayability level by level, but not too much. We might eventually go to the second level. Maybe. I'm not sure. We don't have a burning desire to go back to it. It was pleasant. And we were more or less interested in a light decision-making, pleasant kind of rompish thing.
Yeah, and you're happy that it fulfilled what you were looking
Precisely.
For.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. That having been said, it wasn't terribly remarkable in any of its aspects. It was just, it fulfilled the specific mood and vibe that we wanted. So that was Forgotten Depths by Peter Albertson and Void Knight Games. Occasionally with some decisions. The part I enjoyed most was the cooperative tiling. Just setting out the dungeon in such a way and having various trade-offs. Like, ooh, we want to make that shape because we want to go do the thing and see what it is. And sure enough, then you go see what it is and you get to see a nice picture and a little bit of pretty standard dungeon delving stuff. It's like, hey, there's this statue. Hey, there's this suit of armor. Hey, there's this whatever. But the art really sells the experience. And so that was Forgotten Depths.
You were nice enough to introduce me to Omicron Protocol. This is by Dead Alive Games, and a lot of it was a review copy that they were sent, nice enough to send to us. This is done by Brendan Kendrick and Bernie Lynn, and it is a two-player skirmish game. And it does a lot of things right. Things they do right is just make movement automatic. You know, you're not paying action points, you're not worrying about, you know, giving anything up just so you can move around the map. Fantastic. It makes line of sight very simple as well, so you're not worried about that. It gets you into the game very quickly. You pick your, you know, your four units that you want to play with, and you're on the board. Some things that I do want to go back to, some things that are a little rough, especially on first play, that is all four of these characters sometimes have two or three special abilities each.
More than that, I think. More like four to six,
Six. And then trying to keep all of that tracked, you know, for the first play, plus all the rules, plus the fact that sometimes in the way, there's all these zombies all over the place. And depending on how much noise you make, they're going to attack you. They spawn more. So it's sort of a common enemy on the board while you're trying to get these objectives.
Just to be clear, they're not actually zombies. No. They're called cybermimetic sociopaths. This is a post-apocalyptic game where in the near future, everyone has cybernetic augmentation. And something unexplained happens that causes most of the population with such augments to start behaving in incredibly violent and erratic ways. Just to be clear.
Yeah, and so it's bad by the fact that you have to constantly upkeep all of this, but it's good in a way that it gives you more opportunities to complete the missions. It's not all about just taking down the enemy. There's the mission objectives, there's killing the out-of-control humans, and then there's also trying to kill your opponent as well.
I quite like the way the Sims work. I agree with you that it's a certain amount of...
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's complicated or hard. It's just the fact that it's every round, you know.
The primary thing that I appreciate about it is that it is grist for a lot of interesting abilities. And on top of the standard tactical considerations, like, well, I don't want to end up next to this large crowd of Sims that will tear me limb from limb, but it also allows you to have characters that are not focused on combat abilities at all, but instead are based primarily on manipulating, avoiding, or sometimes even neutralizing the Sims themselves. And that is very much I appreciate, because if you're going to have characters that are that complicated, I want them to have a certain degree of personality and flavor. And I think that the extra dimension offered by the way the Sims work is a great way to do that. And for what it's worth, the solo mode is quite interesting as well. I've played it in the past, and the way that it activates the Sims is slightly different from the way that it works in the competitive game, but nonetheless relatively easy to apply. And I've played a number of different tactical skirmish type games with AI activation, and Omicron Protocol has a pretty good system for dealing with it.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can sort of... because everything you do creates some sort of noise, and so you can sort of math it out and create just enough noise that all of the Sims are out of the zone, and so you're not worried about them attacking you that turn.
Or best yet, if you're really clever, you can make it so that your noise activates Sims, but not in such a way that they can come get you, precisely in the way that they can come get your opponent.
It's true.
Those moves, I wasn't able to pull any off, but I really appreciate it when I'm able to do those. Now, part of the blame is me. We bypassed the tutorial. There's a tutorial which kind of informs one of my gripes about Omicron Protocol is that it is a relic of the bad old days of Fantasy Flight's heyday of multiple rulebooks where none of the rulebooks are comprehensive. And so I never remember where to find things. There's a how-to-play document which tells you that you start with a certain number of action points, which is not true for the full game. And so I never remember how many action points you actually start with in a full game. Now, does that mean I should only play the tutorial over and over? I don't think so. I don't think that's the proper lesson to take. And the action point system, for what it's worth, is also one of the great things about Omicron Protocol. You have a pool of action points. The answer is 8, by the way. 8 or 9 if you're the second player, just for the record. I say this in the hopes that I will remember next time I play Omicron Protocol. And you can allocate those action points as you want. Activate a character, and you want them to be the star of this round. You want to give them half the action points of your entire team. Go to town. Go do that. Have them go and attack a whole bunch of times or do a whole bunch of other special abilities. That's fine. Somebody else doesn't matter. They don't need to really get any. That's fine, too. And I appreciate that freedom when it comes to skirmish-type activation games. If there's a neat activation mechanism such that they have a certain degree of freedom, I really appreciate that. There are games I'm perfectly willing to play where it's like, all right, on your turn, you do one move and do one action. It's like, that's fine, I guess. But if you can spice it up a little bit, I really appreciate that. Like Flick Fleet, for example. You don't move and do one action. You get to activate two different systems, which could be moving and could be shooting, but doesn't have to be.
And they have all sorts of different factions as well. And there's every faction has its own sort of like clan ability, which is kind of interesting. That is not really prevalent in most skirmish type games.
Yes. Omicron Protocol, for good and ill, I think, and I really think that this is just one of its strengths, also one of its weaknesses, never loses an opportunity to give special abilities to a unit. And if you're tired of generic units, Omicron Protocol could be what you're looking for. I remember anybody who plays tabletop miniatures game, this is kind of sort of the problem that Malifaux 1st and 2nd edition had. You'd look at a given unit like a given grunt, just a standard grunt unit in Malifaux, and it's like, okay, this is a line trooper. Here are its 12 abilities. It's like, all right. Number one, that's awesome, but number two, I'm never going to be able to do all this properly. And that's kind of where I'm sitting with Omicron Protocol. I'm very happy to play it. It's great. As you say, it gets a lot of things right. And I've just accepted the fact, again, having been trained in Malifaux, I just accept the fact that at the end of the game, I might be rereading a character card. It's like, oh, I really should have activated that. Oh, I take one less damage in that context. Oh, well, maybe next time. As you say, there are lots of different factions. There are 2 in the base box. There are 2 more in Up to No Good, which is a great name for an expansion. Those are the ones we got in the review copy. The Critical Condition expansions I actually pledged for on crowdfunding myself, which is an indication that we enjoyed the system. You know, if we get a review copy and then I throw more money at the product, that's an indication that we like what's going on. And the Critical Condition expansion were just 2 very small expansions, a single unit that can be used by a couple of different factions. One of them is a cybernetic Komodo dragon. And when the world offers you the possibility of a cybernetic Komodo dragon, you say yes.
It's so true. So that's Omicron Protocol.
Close.
Omicron.
Close.
Omicron?
Also close. That works. Omicron.
By Dead Alive Games, the same people did Lunar Rush.
I don't know if there are 2 ends of a spectrum or what, but those are 2 very interesting entrants at a burgeoning publication company.
Now, a lot of games I say I want to get back to. Lunar Rush is a game I desperately want to get back on the table.
Sure.
I really much enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll happily spend the 45 minutes to get Lunar Rush back to the table. It's... not my preferred version of pick up and deliver, but It's prefer pick up and deliver, and that kind of throughput concerns are not my preferred style of game. But Lunar Rush does it in a very unique way.
That's what I mean. Yeah, I'm not saying it's, you know, the greatest game, but it does cube pushing in a very interesting way.
Yes, yeah. And if you're gonna do a cube pusher, it has the same sort of temporal approach of things like Furnace, which is like we'll get in and out in about 30 to 45 minutes, which is the way to do it.
Just so.
After about, you know, 90 minutes of cue pushing, unless there's something really clever keeping it together, like in Sidereal Confluence, I'm like, okay, fine. I turn the 3 red cubes into 2 blue cubes, and then I turn the 2 blue cubes into points. Sorry, that was my less than enthusiastic voice.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh. Right.
Just to be perfect.
Okay.
Anyway, that was Omicron Protocol. Glad you enjoyed it, Walker. It is one of my preferred boxed skirmish games. We played Among Cultists, a social deduction thriller. This is also a review copy we got from the publisher. This is from Godot Games. My previous experience with Godot Games was Human Punishment 2.0, which frustrated me because it was less a social deduction game in my experience, in my impression, than it was an action card take that game with a sort of a vague social deduction pasted on top. Among Cultists is a big box social deduction game, which is not terribly common. And it seeks to be a board game implementation very explicitly of Among Us, the PC/Android game that many people became obsessed with during the days of the pandemic, and that Benoit Blanc is incapable of playing correctly, whether he's in the tub or not. And Among Us is, I played Among Us. I didn't get obsessed with it the same way that other people did. And there were a number of attempts, I remember, of fan-made versions of Among Us. And one of the difficulties is, Among Us works as a computer game, because nobody really knows where you are at a given time. And where people are is one of the key things about deduction. And it's like, how do you do that in a board game? Well, some people try to do it with hidden movement. Among Cultists doesn't do it with hidden movement. Everyone's placement is known publicly. What they do, however, is thematically confusing but mechanically satisfying. And that is, you don't know when you're dead.
True. But the other thing that you can do with a computer game is you can run multiple games very quickly. Reset,
yes,
go again.
That
reset,
is true.
Reset, go again.
That is true.
Not so much with Among Cultists.
Okay, so you felt it drag?
A little bit.
Really?
Just for the type of game it is. This is not my type of game.
Yes.
This not perfect information type thing is just not my thing. I prefer more of the Mysterium, Tokyo type sort of, here's sort of inferences on what you're trying to get to and sort of like work together. And like the killer in Deception Hong Kong, you know, he's not going to take players out of the game.
They're
not going to take players out of the game. They're just there to, you know, mess it up a little bit type thing.
Huh. Interesting. Because Among Cultists also has the potentially thematically problematic aspect that ghosts still get to play. They get to vote. This is a literal plutocracy, as in the dead get to vote, or perhaps necrocracy. I'm not really sure which of the two is the accepted parlance, because plutocracy typically means rule by the rich, but setting all that aside. And we had somebody get killed explicitly because we possibly someone thought that they were untrustworthy, and someone, certainly not me. I would never do such a thing.
Yeah, no one tried to talk anyone out of it either.
I would never organize a mob and ignore Walker's advice and murder someone because I thought they looked shifty. That is not something I would do and sounds very much unlikely. I mean, how dare you imply otherwise?
That never happened.
Yeah. No, but I'm surprised by your specific stated concerns. Like, if you don't want social deduction games to last past a certain length, that's fine. That's just purely a matter of preference. I don't think that anyone was sidelined because I was actually quite pleased with the overall arc of the session. During the very early turns, I was like, I don't know how this is going to develop. But sure enough, when the mid-game rolled around, as we got to the end game, things were building to a head because the victory conditions of the good guys were just within reach. But we knew that whoever the bad guy was doing a pretty good job of getting in our way, and or we weren't exactly sure how far they'd gotten in terms of their murder quota. And that tension drove a lot of both the suspicion and the actions. And I thought it was very, very good at maintaining interest over the 90-minute playtime. But you disagree.
It's long. No, it's just, because you're not really doing much. Like you said, you go into rooms, you get some books. I don't think there's a chance that one person is going to be able to track down exactly who the killer is. So therefore, they're going to have partial information and they're going to have to try to either convince the other people. And then even in our game where...
But that's always true. Like, that's true of Deception Murder in Hong Kong. Like, I don't...
But nobody... Yeah.
But nobody what?
But, I mean, it doesn't last that long.
Sure. Okay, fair enough. I see. It's the uncertainty coupled with the length that you object
to. And then in our game, it didn't really matter because it had the Merlin rule where and the killer just named a person and all what we did for that 90 minutes didn't mean anything because he just happened to guess right.
I don't agree with your gloss on the fact that it made things irrelevant. I don't like that it can lead to the possibility of a blind guess being successful. But the whole Merlin rule, we're calling it the Merlin rule because that's how Merlin works in the Resistance Avalon. All things being equal, I agree with you, between the Resistance Normal Original, the Resistance Simpliciter, and the Resistance Avalon, I'll take the Resistance Simpliciter 10 times out of 10. Precisely because it leads to a certain degree of randomness in the worst case scenario.
I can see the whole reason behind the Merlin thing, because one person knows...
It is optional, I should say.
They know who the killer is.
Yes.
And if they emphasize that too much, then obviously they're going to give it away. In our case, the killer said he just made a random guess.
Yes.
And he just happened to guess right.
Yes. And that is when it is not good. People do enjoy this added level of sophistication. A lot of people... So look, there are a lot of different ways that people like to approach social deduction games. And to its credit, among cultists, gives people a certain degree of options. There's some people who refuse to play social deduction games, whether it's Werewolf or the Resistance, unless there's like a list of special rolls as long as your arm. If you want to play among cultists that way, you can play among cultists that way. If instead, like me, you want to be more of a quote-unquote purist, you don't have to play with any special rolls in among cultists. Now, at that point, it's still not going to be as deterministic and as much of a logic puzzle as it would be in the Resistance, because you still have to engage in a certain amount of inference. But I just have to say, in terms of the arc, in terms of bearing its weight, in terms of bearing its rules grit, which is non-trivial, especially in light of the rulebook, which is regrettable, I think, in a lot of ways, I was very pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed Among Cultists. That having been said, unlike you, I very much enjoy social deduction games.
I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. It was a fun experience. I definitely wouldn't mind trying it again, and I think it would go a lot quicker now that we knew how to play.
Yes.
That being said, the setup is semi-egregious.
Yes.
But
I am hopeful, I'm curious and hopeful, and perhaps slightly optimistic, that now that I actually know what's going on, the rulebook does a very bad job of giving you a sort of overall view about how the setup works, why you're doing the setup the way that you're doing it, and in terms of the overall card flow once the game actually starts. Everything's there. There's no summary of the available actions you can do, which is awful. But it's hard to internalize. And so my rules explanation took far longer than it should. And the setup was very, very involved. I don't know. And I think I might have an opportunity in the near future to see how quick I can get it and how I can communicate it to a new group of people. I'm also curious about the expansions. And here's why. There are two expansions that are available at present that change the main board. It's not a sideboard. It's not another group of other things that are going on. Although you can do it, there are little teeny modules involved that you can inject if you want. But it's just, here's a new board with a new layout and...
Is it a beach house?
No, it's not the beach episode, unfortunately. Oh. I'm sorry. You seem so disappointed. No, there's a mine and there's another locale. And that I think that's a good approach as far as expansions go to a game like this. At any rate, Among Cultists, I think, did a reasonably good job of inducing some of the same paranoia that Among Us did. It's like, why are you going there? Why are you following me? Why are you ending up at the same space as I am? No. Someone else come join us. We need a witness. Things like that. And it had the mechanical setup induced the kind of paranoia, suspicion, and trade-offs that are involved in social deduction in a way that I like. Is it more random than the Resistance? Absolutely. But a lot of people don't like how deterministic and therefore stress-inducing the Resistance can be. But I think, yeah, again, with five players, which is the player count we had, I would not include the Merlin role again for precisely the concerns you have. And also, I discovered that Huey's objection to that structure, as well as yours, is, if anything, stronger than mine. So, a worthy experiment, but one perhaps best not repeated. The Seer, specifically, not Among Cultists. So that is Among Cultists, a social deduction thriller by Stéphane Godot at Godot Games in 2023. I made a Waiting for Godot joke a couple weeks ago in Pledge of Indifference that has completed my requirement for this quarter, and so I will not be making another one. If you want to hear me make another Godot joke, you'll have to wait for it.
Please, no.
Did you see what I did there?
Yeah, I did.
Did you get that? Yeah. Those are the games we played last week. Now for a quick break while we pay some bills.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And we're back. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
We like oink games. We like dexterity games. There's a game called Rafter 5, Mark, where you put...
Rafter? One who rafts.
One who rafts, it is. It's not ceiling. It is it is definitely a raft. You put the bottom of the box down, and then you lay all these planks across it, and then you start putting... You know, different sized meeples and squares and cubes and
I'm there.
Different stuff. Exactly. I just had to see the picture and it's like, yep, click, 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 click.
Yeah, exactly.
So it'll be out soon enough. This is Rafter 5, designed by Masahito and Jun Sake. Coming out by Oink Games.
This is a repeat from Pledge of Indifference, but we received a review copy of Wizards of the Grimoire some months ago, or as we affectionately refer to it here in Survey Wrong by Gamesland, Bookie Bookie Pew Pew. And it is a two-player dueling game that has a raft of unique spells, and it is about building your engine really quickly and depleting the energy of your opposing character. It was an unexpected joy, and we're big fans of Wizards of the Grimoire. And it is a local Canadian project, so, you know, insert patriotic filler here. This is our CanCon, so if anyone from the CRTC is listening, this is our Canadian content regulation.
Like, full.
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't pack any more Canadian content in this.
I've already said we only hire Canadian gibbons.
There's at least six beavers on the floor here.
Now there's going to be an expansion. This is an expandalone, so a standalone expansion is up on Kickstarter now. It's called Wizards of the Grimoire Shifting Sands. Now, and I just want to issue a special public service announcement for Americans who might be experiencing sticker shock. Your mighty greenback makes it so that the listed price is way lower for you. Don't get confused. And so it remains a cheap and cheerful game, and I'm very optimistic about the mechanical innovations of Shifting Sand in that it will encourage you to cycle your engine more and have to adapt to changing circumstances. And so that is definitely something I'm going to be pledging for. That is Wizards of the Grimoire Shifting Sands on crowdfunding now.
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now onto our main review, Voidfall.
Voidfall was designed by Nigel Buckle and David Tsirtse. They are the design duo who put out Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends. Very much appreciated civilization-themed deck builder put out by Osprey Games. And this is a, well, big box is one way to put it. This is the latest big box released by Mind Clash Games. They of the incredibly expensive, sprawling, elaborate mini expansions in one heavy Euro design company. David Tertze, independent of Nigel Buckle, has designed a great many games, among them Anachrony for Voidfall Games as well, and as well has lent his name, and this is the polite way of saying taking credit for other people's work, for a large number of solo designs, because he has a studio of a variety of people working under him, whom he has only started lately to credit on design work. Anyway, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Voidfall?
Like a spaceship gliding through space, Voidfall slides down an edge with 4X, tech trees, plastic behemoths on one side, and elegant, fast-moving, intertwining mechanism Euros on the other. Blah, 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 Mark. There is alien races. They were corrupted, right? They spread out and helped people.
Yeah.
And then they were corrupted with Voidborn, and Voidborn came out. And now everyone's against the Voidborn. Pew, pew, pew. So.
Wow.
Mostly what you're doing in Voidfall is that you have a hand of cards and a sort of event card will be revealed at the beginning of every turn. It'll tell you how many of those cards you get to play for that round. And you only get three rounds in order to get the highest score you possibly can through, you know, moving through the planets, getting techs, conserving your resources. So many things to do. Voidfall.
So Voidfall is very much a sort of build your own recipe Euro. We talk about recipe fulfillment a lot in terms of Euro games. And to a certain extent, I think recipe fulfillment has become very much before it like tableau building or worker placement. It can just be a lazy way to go do victory conditions. Like, oh, all right, so I have this Euro that generates resources. Okay, so what's the scoring mechanism? I don't know. Let's just have a tableau of things that you can cash in by cashing in a variety of cubes or widgets or whatnot. In Voidfall, the bulk of your points are going to come from you buying these cards, which are themselves victory conditions, and then playing them under certain conditions, and then just having them on your board, your own set of things you need to fulfill. And in so doing, that is a way to whittle down the vast ocean of possible outcomes and things that you can emphasize. Whether it's resources, certain map presence, various different kinds of map presence, various kinds of economic production, various kinds of economic stockpile, whether you're racing up the tracks, whether you're doing this, that, or the other. It's all there, but the way to focus your attention, the way to engage in a heuristic so that you're not drowning in the sea of possibilities, to give you some degree of guidance, some degree of focus, is done through these agenda cards. That is, of course, if you are keeping your eye on the prize, which Voidfall does a reasonably good job of keeping you focused.
And they do a great job because you can't just focus on one type of agenda and get multiple copies of it because you can only have one copy, so you can't just, you know, double dip into, like,
right,
one aspect of the game.
Yeah, you can't just get a series of overlapping military agendas and romp all over the map and laugh at everybody. You can only have one kind of each, and there are four different suits, and naturally they reward different kinds of things. Now, there's a certain generalization printed on the display about what kind of agendas reward various kinds of things. There's also the generalization of what bonus actions the agendas give you.
There's sort of a penalty to these agendas as well. You can't just simply, you know, grab a bunch of them and start getting points right away, because at the end of every round, there's an upkeep phase where you have to pay a bunch of food for all sorts of different reasons. And one of them is how many agendas you have out. So you're sort of limited and sort of have to make sure you balance everything out.
Absolutely. And balance is indeed the name of the game, because this is, I think, one of the key benefits and under-examined benefit of Voidfall. That is that the round structure, when playing competitively, more on that later, is remarkably sparse given how much game there is. Very often in Euro games, we've become accustomed to a 53-step setup process. Don't worry, Voidfall has that in spades, probably longer than many Euro games you've seen. And then we're familiar with some sort of upkeep phase that consists of 12, 6, 23 steps, what have you. Voidfall loads almost everything into player actions. There's no step where everyone drafts an agenda. You have to take an action to do that. There's no step where everyone produces That's an action you do. If you're drowning in food and you have all the food you're going to need for the rest of the game, go ahead. Never produce food again. You're going to be able to use that in terms of efficiency. The food's not going to spoil. You're going to be paying your upkeep forever. That's fine. You're done. You don't have to worry about food anymore. You're good. And that, I think, is remarkable, both in terms of the overall pacing of Voidfall and in terms of the pressures and freedom that you have in terms of how to satisfy your goals and when. There have been occasions, and this is not true of many other Euros where you have to, where there's food upkeep, where I've just looked at it and said, nah, I'm going to starve. Forget it. I just can't. Nope.
It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Now, does that mean that the food pressures are non-existent? No, it's just it's one thing to keep in mind among many, but it is yet another way in which the game is run by player agency, not by a cumbersome mechanistic overall superstructure. Allow me to stress, when playing competitively. More on that later.
I'm just going to cover this now, too. Unfortunately, some things come in like double layers, right? You can't just take an agenda and suddenly you can start fulfilling it. You have to spend an action to acquire the agenda, and then it sort of comes in your hand and it'll tell you what other cards you have to play in order to put that agenda out. So that's, I'm not saying it's, it might be a card you're going to play anyway, but it's another two-step sort of process. And there's a lot of these in this game where you can't just do something. You have to sort of set it up, which is, a normal Euro thing, but it just sort of like, is a lot.
I hear you. I am willing to forgive it in the case of agendas, because I agree with you, it is a lot, especially insofar as you have to sort of cross-reference what actions allow you to put out agendas, and it's not covered as cleanly as your other trade-offs. Like, if you know that you need to put out a military installation, you can just look at your hand of cards and very quickly skim and see which ones let you put out a military installation. If you know that you want to draft an agenda that you will then be able to play later on this cycle, because there's only three cycles, it is a little bit more difficult. You have to do a little bit more correlation. That having been said, putting out agendas is really important, and you're not going to be doing it a whole heck of a lot. And so I'm willing to give it a bit of a pass, but I can absolutely see where you're coming from. The rest of it is, I think, just standard Euro kind of management trade-offs, because, military strength effectively is a kind of a two or three step process, depending on how you want to slice it. Economic production is basically the same. You put out the production buildings and then you have to run them. It's a separate step. Most of the time, I think it's relatively straightforward and just leads to more grist for timing considerations. I will grant you for putting out the agendas, it's a little cumbersome.
And sometimes it can be a benefit, because when you play these cards, they come with three actions, and you're only allowed to use two of them. And so early in the turn, you might grab an agenda, and you specifically took it because every time you put an agenda out, it lets you do an action sometimes.
Bonus action, yeah.
Bonus action. And sometimes you either need that extra bonus action because you can only do two of them and now this will give you the third, or you've already played that particular action and now you're going to be able to do it again at the end of the turn. So sometimes you can look through the agendas and say, I don't care what the agenda is.
Right.
I really need to do that action.
Yeah.
So you draft it and then later in the turn you get to do that action again.
Yes. Which again emphasizes the centrality of agendas. And it helps, again, in games with this many moving parts as Voidfall has, it is helpful to be able to say, this is where you're going to get your points. As opposed to, does it end up having as many elements as a lot of point salad Euros? Absolutely, 100%. But it doesn't feel as arbitrary or as aimless, because this is, again, the recipe that you made. You can feel a sense of ownership. It's a sense of personal responsibility. It's pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. That's what Voidfall believes in. Voidfall doesn't believe in handouts. I seem to have lost the plot. And so it really does feel like a greater sense of focus in a universe of a million different possibilities. Is now the time to talk about icons?
I was just saying, iconography.
Yes. What is your impression of the iconography in Voidfall, Walker?
I think there's a lot of it, but I think it is just very good. As we saw in the Teach, right? As soon as you got over a few of the icons, as we're playing out the cards and what they all do, I think we got through like two of them, and then I did the next six automatically by just looking at the pictures.
And it's really willing to be redundant. I really appreciate that. For example, just a quick example. In order to score something, in order for something in a sector to score, say you need a certain amount of economic production or a certain amount of population or a certain amount of military strength in a given sector, it has to not be corrupted. It has to be free of the corruption. Sometimes this is extra burdensome to get rid of the corruption. It's part of that two or three step process that I'm willing to defend as part of the glorious trade-offs of a dense euro. But every time there's a scoring card, every time there's an event that keys off of having these assets, it repeats the not corrupted icon every single time. And they went to the effort of making sure that you didn't have to take pretty much anything as a given. It's repeated there each and every time. And I really approve of that.
And even though it's repeated, you still you don't forget. But the rest of the table.
Well, again, but that just emphasizes the importance. Like,
yeah, that's what I mean.
With a game with as many details as Voidfall, we have seen lots of games. So let's just compare a simpler game that we also enjoyed this week, Among Cultists, right? Vastly fewer details in the universe of that game. A tiny fraction of the amount of complexity and moving parts that exists in Voidfall. But there's no summary of available actions in Among Cultists, and so we constantly referring back to the rulebook. I refer back to a rulebook of Voidfall hardly ever, because it's all covered in a very nice structure that basically explains itself. And that's a minor triumph, considering how much is going on. And what you're left with, therefore, is, again, it's just always thrown back to the player in terms of, we are going to put the pressure on you to figure out what you want to do, not how you're going to grapple with the systems. It is one of those things where I almost feel, and this is incredibly high praise, we're both big fans of Splatter. We're both big fans of Mind Clash. They have very different design philosophies, even though they both design sort of heavy Euro games. I think Voidfall manages to capture some of the best of what Mind Clash does, as well as some of the straightforwardness and some of the pointed trade-offs of a Splatter design. There's a bit of a reach, and it's certainly more complicated and more Baroque than a Splatter design, but I feel that same focus, even when I don't feel it in other Mind Clash games that I really like Cerebria or Anachrony.
Agreed. So let's get into some of the other parts of it. So the very first thing happens, let's go right to the very beginning. Set up.
So there was this big bang.
Set up and tear down is quite a beast. And
set up this all depends on really painful.
This could also depend on what kind of version you have, because it's a Kickstarter, you could have all sorts of different components and whatever. But even I think, no matter what version you have, it's pretty brutal.
Yes. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to print up a second copy of the scenario book, not all of the scenario book, but of the scenarios. Very much like I did with the glossary. So the glossary, again, redundant as all get out, and therefore super helpful. Never takes anything for granted, with the exception of ship abilities. Minor gripe, that's at the back of the rulebook, for some reason. But it always spells everything out. So I printed out a second copy of the glossary. So there are two that are going around, so multiple people can check the glossary at any given time. Invaluable. Hardly ever look at the rulebook, check the glossary all the time. But that's fine. I'm going to do the same thing with the scenario book so that more than one person can set up the game at the same damn time, because a given hex in a setup for the scenarios of Voidfall might have like 7 or 8 different elements in it. And if only one copy of the book exists, only one person can be doing it because it's just too small. You can't put it in the middle of the table. First of all, there's no room on the table. The table's already covered. Voidfall's taken all of it.
It is Voidfall now.
There is no table, merely Voidfall. And so in order to have someone else be able to help me set the thing up, I'm absolutely going to print another copy of all the scenarios. So be like, here, you do this part.
All right, so now that everything is set up, you now get to choose a faction. And this is where it gets even more interesting. Because once you choose from the 14 different factions that there are, most of them have special abilities. Some of them also have unique home tiles. They might have some focus cards, like unique focus cards.
Unique action cards that nobody else has,
You switch them out with your main deck. Each faction has 2 sort of main tech trees that you can go down. So you choose one, and not only does that tell you what tech you're going to get at the beginning of the game, it'll also tell you what resources you're going to get at the game. And
your starting military disposition.
And how many, the population, all of that stuff. And every faction, there's these 3 civilization tracks that you're moving up for during the whole game that give you all sorts of different benefits. And every faction's tracks are different.
And This leads to an area where Voidfall, I think, is not quite as good as a lot of its 4X competitors. And this is one of the ways in which I think Voidfall isn't really giving you the same feel as a 4X game. It's close, but I don't think it's all the way. But there is a shocking amount of flavor in what goes on in a lot of what Voidfall is, despite the fact that at its core, it's 100% Euro through and through. So, for example, one of the factions, the one I played today, as in point of fact, does not have a conquest card. It instead has a card that you replace it with called Uplift. The top action, though, of Uplift is Bombardment, and it allows you to invade. This is telling you... No, seriously. I spent a lot of time thinking about this. It was so... And it was sufficiently impactful that Huey, who played them like a week and a half ago, was like, yeah, I remember that. Uplift with Bombardment. And it's telling a little bit of a story there. Like, that's telling you something. No, we don't do conquest. We uplift. It's like, so why are you raining down death from orbit? No. This is just part of the uplift process.
We're uplifting their souls.
Yeah. So, there, you know, again, I'm not going to say that this is as thematic as even a game of Eclipse, I think, which is still pretty Euro. Like, you're not going to be outfitting your specific little toys of it. Like, this is my fighter. It's bespoke. It's got the technology that I found at this weird planet and this strange generator that I researched. It's not going to get to that level. At the end of the day, it feels like a management game through and through. But for a management game, it's got a lot of flavor. For a 4X game, not a whole lot. But for a management game, super flavorful.
Agreed. Let's go back to the sort of the planetary sectors that you were talking about, because like you said, there could be up to 7 different items on them. They are double layered, which is great because
in the deluxe version,
in the deluxe version,
Kickstarter version,
because you're putting in your sort of space stations and you're also putting in these guilds,
production guilds,
we'll talk about later. And because
and your population die,
and because they're layered, the stands, and even if you don't have stands, the ship tokens will lie flat, so they won't be teetering or, you know, get in the way. And
honestly, that I think is the best argument in favor of the deluxe version. I think the retail version, I've seen the retail version. The retail version is still the same game and is no slouch in the visuals department. But just having that, the dual layer sector tiles, just meaning that nothing's going to slide off. That alone, I think, is reason to justify it. Not necessarily the outlandish price and consumption of materials, but it makes me glad that I have it. I would happily play on the retail version, but I'm glad I made the decision I did because there are so many elements on a sector tile, and knowing that they're not going to fly off and get shoved over, it's like, wait, where was that farm? Sorry, I was moving a fleet. I knocked over a farm. Where does it belong? That is peace of mind.
Yes, because every sector has a limit of how many guilds are allowed to be slotted in, and depending on, you know, how many you have there, it could lead to that feeding cost. Of
additional
the
upkeep. Additional well, that's upkeep. What ARC ships are for, Walker. It's just so you can overload a given sector. Anyway.
Yeah, that... What you're saying there leads back to the technologies, because what races people play or factions people take,
they're all technically human,
will dictate the technology for everyone for the whole game.
Yep.
And it will tell us what kinds of ships that we're going to be able to have, because you always get corvettes no matter what. And then just depending on what factions are in play, you're going to all sorts of different variety of ships. So you might not get anything but corvettes because no one's taken the factions that have fancy
but
ships.
These might be corvettes with advanced targeting and shields.
It's true.
Or you can play with the carriers and the destroyers and the dreadnoughts and so forth.
And on a side note, you might have some, I keep calling them city-states, but they're lost...
They're fallen houses.
Fallen houses. So in a lot of the scenarios, you're going to have fallen houses, which are sort of like city-states in Civilization. And when you take them over, you can get their technology. So you might get ships that way.
And they determine what technologies are available overall. So the overall technology field is not determined by a blind draw or random influx or a deterministic deck, just to mention Eclipse and Twilight Imperium as examples, but instead is a function of the technologies selected by the players as a function of their starting factions, and 8 that are driven by the available pool of fallen houses. And this leads to a very different tenor as opposed to the overall game, each individual session of Voidfall, which leads me, I think, to discussion of the scenarios. You pick a given scenario, and there's a fixed map setup that is varied a little bit by the starting faction elements, and it's going to tell you, these are the suggested factions from the players from which to choose. You can vary if you want to. And these are the suggested fallen houses. You can vary that if you want as well. It will also give you a suggested set of event cards, and there's some randomness there. But I've got to say, when I initially saw this setup, and when I internalized how Euro the gameplay was, I was a little bit skeptical about how much the different scenarios were going to feel next to each other. What was your overall impression about the different scenarios?
I think it was very much, they were very much different, because they all had sort of like a conflict rating, right? How much interaction there was going to be, and that really was dictated by how much corruption was in the way between the players. And or if you ever played Forbidden Stars, you'll know that there's these warp gates all over the place, or static charges that move around and block off different parts of the map. And this is prevalent in Voidfall as well, except they just don't move. So it just sort of like helps manipulate the map around and close off areas and create choke points. And sometimes this is very relevant because at the end of every turn, the Voidfall attack, and they're only going to attack if they're adjacent to some of your sectors. So you can sort of, you know, bust out early. So there's only that one sector that's adjacent. So you can keep that in defense and then not have to worry about getting, you know, destroyed in the back.
Yes. You've complained in the past, or at least observed, that you felt that it wasn't that Voidfall that Voidborne counterattack wasn't sufficiently consequential. Do you still feel that way?
No, I understand why it's there. I just the time it takes to go through it when it's obvious that we've all, you know what I mean?
Really?
I'll
repeat what I said before. I think it plays a substantial role in my decision making in terms of how I set up my sector defenses, and then at the end of the round when it's time to execute it. At that point, it's anticlimax. We've already done the work.
Yes, exactly.
And so the actual resolution is, okay, you're fine because it gets blown out of the sky. I'm fine because they show up and I kill them. You're fine because you actually don't suffer an attack. And that part, you know, that amount of time is practically nothing, but it nonetheless influences the decisions I've made up to that point.
Maybe it's not the time. It's just so much that nothing ever happens. So
sure. It's kind of like a duck. All the action's happening underwater.
It's true. I want to hit the Galactic Event cards because I did sort of talk about them. So after you pick your faction and you get going, the first thing you do is flip over this Galactic Event card. And it's going to give you a few goals. It might give you a few benefits right off the beginning.
Or burdens.
But the part I find most interesting is what I alluded to earlier, is it's going to tell you how many cards you get to play that turn. And I think that's very interesting because sometimes you get to 6 or 4 or 5. You just never know how many actions you're going to get. And I think that's sort of, that adds a lot of tension to every turn.
Sure. It's part of the way in which the different scenarios in Voidfall end up producing different kinds of games. We've had scenarios where we all felt rich and it was a question of running up the scoreboard. We've also had scenarios where we all felt really poor and we felt like we couldn't get done what we had gotten done in the previous game. And I really think it helps give a sense of variety. It is shocking how much difference you get out of the different scenarios based on what seems like so much small input variance.
Agreed. Let's just cover combat is very deterministic. There's no dice. It tricks you. You know, you look at the component list, you'll see lots of dice.
Oh, yeah. Tons of dice. Yeah.
You never roll them.
Yeah, they're just trackers. Yeah.
So combat is very deterministic. You know if you're going to win or not. You just go in and you go through the motions and say, yeah, shields, torpedoes, I lose one, I win, move on.
Yeah.
Which is great, especially in a game of this length and how much combat could bog it down. I am so glad that this is the type of combat.
I have seen comments from a variety of people that say that it is too hard to figure out what the results of combat are going to be. And I do not understand what they're talking about. I find it very, very difficult to understand. Like, there's an app that you can use to resolve combats, but the input involved in just like I have this technology and I am not scroll one carrier scroll like,
yeah.
What the heck?
I did go through that, like, because I loaded in doing the research for this. I downloaded like all the rule books,
and
then I scroll down a bit and it says, oh, there's an app, and I click on it and I go, what is this? Well, this is a combat app, and I go, what on earth would you do? Why would you? I don't.
It's also baffling because why would you start an attack without knowing what the results would be? So I have to assume it's what people would try on spec to figure out what would happen if they attacked. I have never had any difficulty. I sincerely don't know why people, like, where I have a whole bunch of technologies and the victim has a whole bunch of technology. I think we only ever had one attack where someone was like, I think I'm going to win, but I'm not exactly sure what the end state's going to look like. Here we go. I think that's once. In all the games we've had.
Yeah, and because they have these really useful overlays. Depending on what ships are in the game, you bring those overlays over.
Yep.
It shows you what happens in every stage of the combat, so you can just look over there. It's like, oh, okay, my shields will stop that. I'll do this. The torpedoes will kill them both.
Yep.
I have initiative. That's how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And we're done.
And that's a complicated example.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Just so.
Yeah. I have to, I mean, I just assume it's sincere. What's easy for some people is hard for others and vice versa. This is not in any way a reflection of intellectual capability. It's just the players that we've played with have not had a difficulty internalizing the combat system, whereas other people seem to. So for what it's worth.
All right. So there's only three rounds of the game, and the average number of cards you're going to play is 5. So you're going to play 15 cards and the game will be over. And then the last thing I have here before we go about the different versions is the components. We've sort of talked about some of it, but I like to talk about the resources. Instead of having all these tokens and whatever, you have this like one sort of cylinder of all these dials that keeps track.
Big, yeah, 10 dials on a big plank.
Yeah, 10 dials. It tells you what your sort of output is, or what's the proper word for it? Output. And then when you run those, it tracks the actual resources as well, so it's all on this one little card, so it's not like all these tokens all over the place. Love that. And yeah, the double layered sector boards, which I already talked about, and the ships are very interesting looking. They have two different colors of plastic for the Voidborne ships. And yeah,
again, in the deluxe super expensive version, more money than sense. In the retail version, they are just tokens where you put cubes on them to represent their strength. And to be frank, the tokens with cubes are probably more functional than the stands with cubes. But I am not a smart man. I'm not wise with money. And when someone says plastic spaceships, I enter into a fugue where I lose all self-control. So
it's like you know, when you get that concussion, there's that explosion. And then everything goes fuzzy. And then in the background, all I hear is pew, pew. Pew, pew.
What's that, God? What's that?
All right.
You worship blaster sounds? Yes. It's my religion.
So there's different ways you can play. There is competitive, there are multiple versions of that. It'll give you like a number, and you can say, I want this degree.
From 1 to 4, yeah. This degree of conflict, yeah.
Conflict.
So let's talk about that first. We've tried, we've actually played scenarios with all 4 of the ratings. And at level 1, it's more or less impossible to fight another player. Even if you tried real hard to do nothing but fight another player, you might, by the end of the game, have a potential fight or two. And that's if you're focused on just doing that. I don't care about winning. I just really want to get there. And then there's level 4, where it's like, after your first conquest, you're right next door to each other. And so anybody can attack anybody, more or less, at that point. What was your impression of those parameters in Voidfall, Walker?
Well, the parameters were fine, but I just don't see the reason of attacking other players, especially when there's Voidborne sectors available.
Yeah.
The benefit of attacking Voidborne is so much better than attacking another player. Unless it's specifically slowing them down somehow.
Yes. It's the way the conflict system works is after you've conquered a whole bunch of Voidborne, you become a juicy target, because when somebody conquers your sector, they score all of your military trophies, effectively. And then you lose a military trophy because it's been embarrassing. Now, on paper, I really like this, because the idea is like you get more points for winning, for beating up a big military force. And number 2, as somebody suffers military loss, they become less juicy of a target, right? But in practice, what that means, first of all, how good a military target somebody is only determined by how much they beat up the NPCs. So somebody comes and kicks you in the teeth, your incentive to fight back against them is practically nil. Your incentive to go get more points is to just beat up more Voidborne. Oh, great, then you're the target again. So there's not an interest or incentive to constantly mix it up with each other. This ain't Kemet or Senji, people. This is a situation where, as a consequence of your having done real good against the NPCs and left your borders undefended, someone's going to snipe at you. And it's not really in your interest to attack them back. But then again, it's not really in your interest to go attack more any NPCs anymore. So the high conflict scenarios discourage fighting all round as a consequence of the way they do the incentive structure. It's baffling.
And there's huge upkeep, because leaving a sector after you've conquered it is huge penalties, because you lose everything that's there.
Yep.
The Voidborne instantly come back in and reoccupy it.
And it's a major roadblock now. Yeah. And I mean, you could theoretically use it as a sort of defensive bastion. But as I said, there's not really a reason for people to come after you again after you've been kicked in the face. Voidfall, and this is probably something to emphasize throughout, huge, huge multiplayer solitaire vibes. Walker was quite right to praise the fact that the resource tracker is very, very functional, and you don't have to worry about lots of trailing tokens for that. There are lots of trailing tokens of other type, don't worry. But as a consequence, your neighbor could have the best scientific production and stockpiles in the world, or could be desperately poor and unable to buy even a basic tech. You don't know. Yeah. You don't even really care.
Yeah. Is he scoring his agendas? Does he have really cool agendas? How do his techs work? Why would you care?
Yeah. It is incredibly multiplayer solitaire. And that is not a feature that I like in general. It's not even a feature that I like in Voidfall. It is purely a function of the quality of that multiplayer solitaire that I enjoy Voidfall as much as I do. It is, I would put it in the same broad category, not in terms of design aesthetic, not in terms of mechanics or anything, as a Feast for Odin. Do I like how multiplayer solitaire it is? No. Am I willing to forgive it based on the rest of the quality of the game? Yes. And its attempts to not be multiplayer solitaire just, in my experience, are some of the least satisfying sessions of Voidfall that I've had. The high conflict scenarios, the ones where we mixed it up, didn't reveal any strengths. The incentive structures are just all over the place.
And there is very minimal grab for the technologies.
A very slight, yeah.
And same with the agendas. If there is a particular agenda that you need, you might want to grab it quickly because
right.
There's one of each and another one will come up, but
yeah.
It might not
be
exactly
as well suited.
Exactly.
Then
especially like say if it was you were playing the co-op mode, which we're just about to talk about.
Yes.
And it's the person with the lowest score is going to be the score of the team. And then if that lowest person with the lowest score has a really good agenda that they're going to score a lot of points with and has an action on it they want. And then the person with the highest score comes along and they take that agenda. That just doesn't seem like teamwork at all now, does it?
I don't know, Walker. What if the person who took that agenda, who had the highest score, was incredibly physically attractive and desirable to members of all sexes and genders?
Oh, could be. Yeah.
And has a dulcet tone for podcasting?
That could be true.
I'd like to meet that person. That doesn't sound much like me.
He sounds quite wonderful.
Yeah. Well, look. I will now quote F. Geb Ledoukas, the great sage and eminent scholar of No Pun Included. First of all, one aspect of the cooperative mode is that doesn't really lead to good feeling, right? At the end of the game, everyone reveals their score. It's like, okay, you're the weakest among us. We win or lose based on how well you did. Congratulations, loser.
Yeah.
That's not awesome.
You are the weakest link.
Yes.
You have failed us.
Yeah, exactly. You have either, yeah, you, if we lose, it's because of you. That's not awesome. And then Voidfall, as we've talked about, is remarkably smooth-flowing, remarkably approachable, and remarkably comprehensible given its weight. And then there's the cooperative version, oof, which says, hey, you've internalized all these systems. Have three or four more. Hey, that round structure that was so breezy and quick and clean, let's add some upkeep to every single turn.
Yeah, but you said that you've internalized it already. But what if people haven't? What if
No,
I don't mean that way. What if their group only plays cooperative
yes,
games?
Yes.
Or they said, oh, it's co-op, let's try that first.
Yeah.
And what if that's the first version
yeah.
they play?
Yeah.
That would be terrible.
Yeah. It is not as bad as some of the David Surtsey solo designs that I've played. It is the mechanisms introduced in the cooperative / solo version are, much like everything else in Voidfall, individually straightforward. But oh my goodness.
It took us almost twice as long to play a cooperative game than to play a competitive game.
Yeah. Yeah. Even our first competitive game.
Yes.
Even our first competitive game with the rules explanation and with you starting not having played the tutorial flowed like silk. And we've tried the co-op version once and the consensus at the table was never again. We
Glad we tried it.
Glad we tried it. Nope.
Will not return.
There are some people who love incredibly dense solo games and would love to set up a table of Voidfall and either spend all day on it or whatever. I am not the kind of person who does solo gaming that way. When there's that much setup, when there are those many components to manipulate, I am going to insist on other hands being around to help me, and I just don't want to have to be able to reach over to the other edge of the board anyway. But it is absolutely the case that even before the pandemic, there was an audience for solo games like this. Especially after the pandemic, there is a whole bunch of people who are going to insist on a cooperative mode in a solo or cooperative mode in every game, and might even buy it exclusively for solo. That audience, just so you know, you have to know what you're getting into. I solo war games, I solo con sims, but typically of like the 2 hour or less, frequently of the David Thompson variety. I solo tabletop miniatures games, frequently of the 45 minutes or less variety. I don't solo 3 hour war games, 3 hour Euros, and even if I did, I wouldn't solo this.
And Mark, when doing the research for this, I'm very sorry that you had to read these rule books, because this doubles down on a huge problem, because they didn't print a solo book.
No.
See, they incorporated all the cooperative and solo rules within the main rule book.
And the tutorial rules as well.
And it's all mixed together, and they color code it.
It's not good, it's bad.
They color code it, but it's still, yeah, it's really bad.
Yeah. As good as the glossary is, and I will defend this as possibly the greatest glossary I've ever seen in hobby gaming, the rule book, they made a series of editorial decisions. I'm not saying that they had any easy outs, but I definitely think they took the wrong editorial decisions. It is the case that there are four different packages of rules. There are the rules, there are the tutorial rules, there are the tutorial rules but not during cycle one, and there are the co-op rules. Actually, sorry, five, and then ones that apply only for competitive. There you go, five sets of rules. And they include them all in the same book. And what it serves to do is very much like a badly written rule book, again, like Among Cultists, serves to obscure the simple and complicate the approachable. Honestly, it is only because of that that I found the tutorial useful. If the rulebook had just been written in a standard rulebook, here are the rules you need to do for the mode you're about to play, I would not have needed a tutorial in order to internalize how everything worked. Look, they had a series of bad options in front of them, and I don't know if the world would have been better if they took one of the other bad options, but quite frankly, given the amount of excellent material in the box, I would have said, look, suck it up, have a couple more rulebooks in there. And then you just have the one document you need for the mode you're playing, and then you're done. Agreed. That would have been my preference. They still could have color-coded it. They still could have color-coded it, like, this is what is different. This is, you know, these, you know, note. You know, we're color-coding things that are different from the other modes, just so you don't get confused. Ugh. Anyway. All of that having been said, right? We're talking about an expensive table hog. It's long, but it's not egregiously long. It's, like, reliably under 3 hours when you know what you're doing. Even for a first time play, if you move quickly, because it really flows shockingly smoothly given how dense the Voidfall is. Every individual element makes sense. You don't really feel like there are stuff that's there that doesn't belong. And it is not quite a 4X, but it gives a little bit of that taste. I really think that this is either my favorite Mind Clash game or possibly second only to Cerebria. I'm not really sure. This is a heavy, long game with about 45 minutes to an hour of setup, and I have always wanted to play it again immediately after finishing it. It has stayed in my game room, and we've played it a lot over the course of the past couple weeks, and that, I think, is a testament to how much I adore Voidfall. I think it is a stunning achievement.
Agreed. Like I said, I think it really cuts down that edge of giving you that feeling of that of 4X and these giant technology trees and huge plastic and that overall scope of feel, but streamlines it into this very interesting Euro mechanism game.
Yeah.
And I can see lots of Voidfall in the future.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us at sowronggames.com/contact. That has all our contact information therein. Sowronggames.com should, of course, be your homepage. It has all kinds of useful information. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. We appreciate your having decided to spend some time with us here at So Very Wrong About Games, and we hope to see you again soon. Please do take care.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.